Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now from Mexico is John Gibler, who is the author of I Couldn't Even Imagine That They Would Kill Us, an oral history of the attacks against the students of Ayotzinapa, and Mexico Unconquered, Chronicles of Power and Revolt, and To Die in Mexico, Dispatches from Inside the Drug War. His work on the 43 missing students from Ayotzinapa Rural Teachers College has been published in California Sunday Magazine, featured on All Things Considered, and praised by The New Yorker. His latest book, Torn from the World, A Story of Forced Disappearance in Mexico, will be released this July. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Gibler.
Thanks very much for having me on the air.
Well, thank you for joining us. And this story I've been trying to follow, it's Byzantine and Machiavellian and convoluted, but now something rather extraordinary has happened, has it not, that the federal court in Mexico has ordered the government to investigate the 2014 disappearances of these four college students again, but this time under the supervision of a truth commission, which is to be led by the nation's top human rights body and the parents of the victims. So that in itself, apparently that's even caught the families of the victims by surprise.
Absolutely. I think this is a ruling that not a lot of people are anticipating, largely because it comes in response to appeals that were filed by a number of the people detained who denounced that they were tortured into signing false confessions. The families and their lawyers were both surprised, though happily so, by this ruling, which, as you said, completely invalidates the entire federal attorney general's investigation, sustaining the claims that it was largely produced through the generation of false confessions under torture, and that it contains gross omissions such as complete failure to investigate federal police participation, as well as the role of the army in the attacks that night.
Well, the government, nevertheless, has been clinging to this absurd scenario that they developed, and they've never explained why these people that were tortured and coerced into confessing, these minor players, local cops and a minor drug ring in rural Mexico, that's always been extraordinary to try and get your head around, the idea that the best they could come up with was a dump somewhere outside of town where it would have been physically impossible to have incinerated all of those students because you wouldn't have had the heat to do so. So it's never made any sense. The Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, which is a part of the OAS, they had a panel of lawyers, investigators, and human rights specialists look into this. But the government turned around and basically fired them or cut them off at the knees. And then we found out later that the Mexican government had these jurists and investigators under surveillance. So I don't think you have to be conspiratorial to wonder, what is it that the government is covering up?
Exactly. As you've just outlined, the federal government's role since the very night of the attacks has been one of lies, torture, the invention of a false crime scene and a false scenario to sustain the story, the absurd story that it started telling from the very beginning. So what could lead, really, the entire force of the executive branch of government to lie for almost 4 years now, 3.5 years, about what is arguably, although not an isolated event, but the most kind of shameful and politically explosive event, atrocity of the administration? Whom are they trying to protect? What are they trying to keep from being found?
So take us back to the actual event itself. It was something, and I hesitate to say routine, but the students often commandeered buses in their political protests. And the school has a kind of Marxist tradition, and I don't know who they angered, but take us through what happened in this town. And one of the things that's extraordinary is that there are, what, 6 killed at the time, 40 wounded, and there's been no accounting on any of that.
You're absolutely right. So that night, the students were as you say, carrying out a somewhat routine, if not very common in the U.S., but for them a somewhat routine political action, which is to commandeer commercial tour buses and use them for either getting to a protest or oftentimes as a part of their state-mandated education curriculum of traveling out into isolated regions of the state to observe elementary schools and the teachers in their classrooms. So they were going out to grab a few buses, the shortest version possible, because these are incredibly complex events. So the students were attacked over a series of about 9 hours, both inside the city of Iguala, as well as attacks that were carried out far outside the city. A youth soccer team was brutally, mortally attacked also by police out on the highway about 15 kilometers outside of Iguala that night. And these attacks were carried out by municipal police officers from three different municipalities, Iguala, Kokula, and Huituco, as well as Guerrero State investigative police officers, Las Policías Ministeriales, as well as uniformed federal police officers. All of these people openly participating, widely observed, widely documented, participating in these coordinated attacks. Another major element is the role of the Mexican Army. The Army has a very large base located right in the city of Iguala. In fact, it's only a mile away as the crow flies from one of the main scenes of attack against the students. And yet the soldiers did not appear uniformed in uniform on the streets until sometime about after 1 a.m., when they forcibly removed some students from a clinic where they had gone to seek medical attention for a student who'd been shot in the mouth, medical attention that was denied to them there. And then the soldiers kind of posed in the shadows around the intersection where two students had been shot and killed, and were there when the reporters from the state capital of Tizpancingo arrived. Those are the reporters who have most of the connections with the international press agencies and took the photographs that night that would be those released on the wire and traveling around the world. This wasn't a confusion. This wasn't anything like a routine confrontation between the openly left-wing students and the police. This was very much a coordinated military-style attack involving hundreds of people taking place over an extended period of time, over a complex and vast geographical area. So obviously an attack that had to have both a command structure and a lot of electronic communication going on, like cell phones and radio communication between the different police forces.
So again, I'm speaking with John Gibler, who is in Mexico. He is the author of I Couldn't Even Imagine That They Would Kill Us, an oral history of the attacks against the students at Ayotzinapa, and Mexico Unconquered, Chronicles of Power and Revolt, and To Die in Mexico, Dispatches from Inside the Drug War. His work on the 43 missing students from Ayotzinapa Rural Teachers College has been published in California Sunday Magazine, featured on All Things Considered and praised by The New Yorker, and his latest book, Torn from the World, A Story of Forced Disappearance in Mexico, will be released this July. So just let me get this straight, though, John, just in terms of the actual casualties, and you got 43 disappeared. You got 6 killed at the actual incident itself, and I understand, was it 40 or 41 wounded? What happened to the 41 wounded? Are they a part of the disappeared number?
No, the student who was most critically wounded is Aldo Gutierrez, who was shot in the head and is in a vegetative state. He's still in a coma, alive, only on life support at a hospital here in Mexico City. Another student was very gravely wounded, shot in the mouth, and has been undergoing a series of reconstructive surgeries to try and repair the teeth and the bone, as well as the tissue that was all obliterated by the gun, or the bullet wound. And then there are a number of students, as well as teachers and other people who had arrived after a first initial attack and were thus out in the street trying to help the students when they were attacked a second time at one of the main locations, And these are people who mostly received gunshot wounds to the arm, to the leg. A number of other students received gunshot wounds to the hand, to the arm. And most of those students have fully recovered or recovered. One student had lost several fingers with one of the gunshot wounds. But yeah, because of the intensity of forced disappearance, the nature of that violence, how it destroys families who can't return to their everyday lives or are forced to look for their missing, in this case, their missing sons. So much of the other impacts of the violence is often left out of the conversation, of memory, the fact that so many people were wounded that night, also people, passengers in taxis on the highway, a number of both the trainers and the young soccer players in the soccer team that was attacked, where three people were killed at that scene of the attack, the bus driver, a 14-year-old soccer player, and a woman who was a passenger in a taxi that was driving by. Oftentimes that scale of the violence, those particular impacts of the violence are left out of the conversation. And then, of course, the very horrifying and brutal story of one of the students, Julio César Mondragón Fontes, who was not only tortured and murdered that night, but mutilated by his killers. They removed his face and eyes before discarding his body in a small pile of trash a few blocks away from one of the scenes of attack.
And on top of all of that, 43 of these students were disappeared.
43 students forcibly disappeared by police, uniformed police officers using their official police trucks to drive away with the students. All of that widely documented, in many cases even photographed with outside surveillance video footage. And yet, they haven't been seen since. Instead, the federal government, spent 3.5 years inventing a fake crime scene, as you said. And I think this is an important point, that within really a matter of hours of the federal government's announcement that these supposed perpetrators had confessed to having incinerated the students in this trash dump, it sounded strange and implausible, because people who know the area know that the trash dump is this vast open area, and then also that it rained all night that night, so it just seemed weird immediately. But the parents traveled out to Cocula the very next day, or within hours of that announcement, and analyzed the trash dump. These are people who live and work in those very mountains, and oftentimes use fire as a part of the cycles of subsistence agriculture. So they were there and saying, no, that a fire of that intensity would have burned all this other vegetation in the area, would have left these kinds of marks on the ground. I mean, they were really the first investigators were the mothers and fathers who went out there, and they were the first to say that this is impossible. But again, because they're campesinos, because they're rural people and not so-called scientists, their knowledge was never validated. Their knowledge was not taken seriously by the state. And now it's taken years and years and all of these different reports and international agencies and now courts to basically come up and say the same thing.
So in this federal court in Mexico that have ordered a new inquiry to be supervised by a truth commission to be set up and led by the nation's top human rights body, along with parents of the victims, in their report issuing this new call for another investigation 4 years later, they point out that there's no sign that the earlier investigations, and that included the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights investigation, which the government sabotaged and essentially ended, they weren't able to follow any leads involving the military and the federales. And the report today that's been announced setting up this new investigation said that there were no signs that any of these lines of investigations that showed possible participation of personnel from the Mexican army and the federal police were ever investigated. So let's focus on that. There's a military base in Nguala, about a mile from the scene of most of this atrocity. It also happens to have a huge incinerator that's capable of disappearing all of these bodies. What's your hunch on this? Because, again, I go back to, without being conspiratorial, if Peña Nieto's government and the Attorney General have gone to such lengths to come up with such ridiculous stories, and they've clung to this in the face of international rebuke from the OAS and from now from the United Nations, nevertheless, they've stuck to this line. So they have to be covering up something that implicates the entire government. And my hunch would be that the military had to be involved.
I share that hunch. I share that hunch both because of the dynamics of the attacks that night and both what the military did and what they didn't do, where they were visibly, right, in uniform, in patrol trucks, and where they weren't. And because, as you say, and I agree, the absurd contortionism that the federal government has pathetically tried to use to divert attention away from the army. You know, here in Mexico, sometimes I'm invited to give journalism workshops, and one of the first things I tell young journalism students is, you know, whenever a major act of political violence takes place, you know, you try to locate and listen to two things immediately. One, of course, what do the survivors and the witnesses say? And two, what is the government's official position? What is, you know, whether it's through a statement or a press release or whatnot? Because almost always when the federal government says X happened, you know that it didn't happen. If they say in Notislan, Oaxaca, right, they say the federal police weren't armed, then you know that they were carrying guns, right? You know what you have to go investigate. You can't just assume, of course, as a journalist, but the initial government enunciation gives you a kind of indication of the work you need to do, the reviews and the interviews and the research you'll need to do to find what really happened. And here it's something similar, where from the very, very beginning, the government has done everything possible to say, don't look at the army, don't talk to the army, don't ask any questions about the army, which leads me, and I think many other people, including, as you've mentioned, the independent investigators that were hired in agreement between the families, the Mexican government, and the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, all said, we need to be interviewing the army. We absolutely have to speak to the soldiers on duty that night, interview all of them, review the 27th Battalion Army base in Iguala. The parents had been protesting outside of that army base for years. And I think you're absolutely right that the court's recent ruling explicitly points to the blatant refusal on behalf of the federal government to let anyone else investigate the army or talk to anyone from the army, and their refusal to do so themselves, of course.
Well, just in the last minute, if you could wrap it up, because this is ultimately the important question, John, at least I think so. The government's never explained what possible motives there were for doing this, for murdering all these kids, shooting recklessly at bystanders and killing young 14-year-old soccer players and bus drivers, and then disappearing 43 of these students. So if it was the army, what was their motive?
Of course, we don't know yet, but I think we have enough evidence, and this was the hypothesis of the independent commission referred to as the GIEI, was the possibility of the students having unknowingly commandeered a bus that was refitted and loaded with a heroin shipment bound for the United States. That possibly could have set off the kinds of attacks that we saw, where they begin with just the police trying to stop the students. And then once they've stopped them, then, you know, different scenes, they do different things. Some of the students, they disappear them, all of them. Some of them, they let them walk away. Some of them, they shoot at them. And a part of that chaos, as well as the intense escalation of the violence, the night gets bloodier and bloodier as it progresses from, say, 9:30 all the way past 1 in the morning, could correspond to something like that, like the students having grabbed one of these buses. Now, in that case, it would be, of course, very notorious that if a drug shipment had been accidentally grabbed, unknowingly grabbed by the students inside one of these buses, that the people called to rescue the drugs were not so-called narcos, right, but the police, and not just any old, perhaps, you know, corrupt cop, but no, all of the police in the entire area from the three levels of government and with the army looking on. That all said, I think that regardless of the initial spark, the initial motivation for attacking the students, simultaneously the character of violence, the intensity of the brutality against the students, this combination of armed attack, murder, mutilation, and forced disappearance is itself very much a political violence targeted at the students for being who they are, for being students from rural and often indigenous communities in some of the most economically battered regions of the country, who not only dare to study, but dare to be intensely vocal and politically active.
Well, John Gibler, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much, Ian. I really appreciate it.
And again, I've been speaking with John Gibler, who's the author of I Couldn't Even Imagine That They Would Kill Us, an oral history of the attacks against the students at Ayotzinapa. Mexico Unconquered, Chronicles of Power and Revolt, and To Die in Mexico, Dispatches from Inside the Drug War. His work on the 43 missing students from the Ayotzinapa Rural Teachers College has been published in California Sunday Magazine, featured on All Things Considered and praised by The New Yorker, and his latest book, Torn from the World, A Story of Forced Disappearance in Mexico, will be released this July. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into a major strategic blunder underway with Secretary of State Pompeo making a deal with Turkey to sell out the Kurds over the objection of Secretary of Defense Mattis.